I'm Mark Olson. I'd like to call the March 21st Local Government Committee to order. Welcome to the committee. Members, we have a quorum present, and since we're getting started a little late, if we could right away, Representative Wardlow, it looks like you're doing a good job at looking over the minutes.
Yes, I'm going to save them, post them, and approve them. So move.
Representative Wardlow moves the minutes be approved from March 16th, Wednesday. Any discussion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The amendments are approved for March 16th. Thank you, members. Representative Powell, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I believe your bill needs to move to civil law. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Representative Peterson.
I will make the motion to pass House File 1555 and move it to civil law.
Okay. Representative Powell moves that House File 1555 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. To the bill, Representative Powell, I see we have some amendments here. Are these yours, or do we need to wait until amendments?
I have no amendments.
Okay. We'll wait until you're done with the testimony then.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. In May of 2002, and within 8 months of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and anthrax scares, the Minnesota legislature extensively amended Minnesota statutes in an attempt to develop a coordinated response plan in the event of a terrorist attack here in this state. These powers are scheduled to expire in August of 2005. The Minnesota Department of Health is now proposing limited changes to the overall state response system for emergencies. These changes are based on a 2003 report mandated by the 2002 legislation. Practical experience learned through drills and exercises and after consultation with the Department of Public Safety. These changes would better protect public health and safety in any type of emergency and reflect an all-hazard approach to planning and response. This model is being used in recognition of the fact that many kinds of emergencies have public health components in common. The all-hazard model provides a coordinated systemic approach to meeting the needs of people affected by an event, including the ill and the injured. All responders, including police and healthcare providers, as well as the public, will be able to focus their efforts through a single, unified system. Better integration of available resources will allow for a faster and more coordinated response to an event. The threshold for the declaration of peacetime emergency is found in Chapter 12.31, Subdivision 2, and this reads in part that, quote, a peacetime declaration of emergency may be declared only when an act endangers life and property and local government resources are inadequate to handle the situation, unquote. Consequently, an act that would trigger a declaration in Cottonwood or Renville counties may not necessarily trigger a declaration in Hennepin or Ramsey counties. Specifically, this bill adds new liability protections in worst-case situations for all responders carrying out emergency plans in good faith. It clarifies that volunteers registered and acting under the direction of state or local government would have the same liability and workers' compensation protections as paid public employees during a disaster or an emergency. This bill sunsets public health emergency language from Chapter 12, allowing the governor and emergency managers to address emergencies of all types with the same broad array of authority. It enables professional licensees from Canada and Washington, D.C. to assist in meeting the needs of a declared emergency, just as Chapter 12 now recognizes licensees from all the other states. It maintains the provisions of identification and care of the deceased in an emergency. And it also maintains the provisions on rights to refuse examination or treatment in an emergency. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have everybody take out, I think everybody should have in their packet, a copy here. It says emergency, Minnesota Emergency Health Powers Act provisions is the first line of it. And I'd like to have you put that beside the bill that you have in front of you. And you'll see that it's quite different. And when I first saw this about 10 days ago, I was quite astonished and ran right up to the revisor's office. The revisor also was thought it looked odd. But they pulled the file, looked at it, and finally decided, well, this has been drafted correctly. And the reason it's drafted the way it is because 2002 is when this bill was first passed here. And went through a very tortuous legislative pathway here in 2002, and it's right now in 2002 session law. So I think I've made sure in the committees that we've been at that this piece of paper that the Minnesota Department of Health provided, I think that this makes it a lot more transparent of what the department is trying to do. So I would have you work off of both documents. So with that, I think that's all I have. I have with me Assistant Commissioner of Department of Health, Aggie Lighthizer, who may have some words for us.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. And as Representative Powell said, this has been a little bit complicated to describe and display because we are taking out or sunsetting the language about a public health emergency and returning to the language that's been in place that is described as all hazards, so that we would use the same approach, the same tools as we use for other kinds of emergencies as we would for emergencies that affect the public health. Some of the changes that you'll see in House File 1555, or in fact most of the changes, are changes that were reviewed and approved by the House in the 04 session. We went through some similar conversations and similar committees. It did not make it through the 04 session completely, so we're back this year with those changes that you'll see in House File 1555. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for questions.
Any questions for the Commissioner? Seeing none? Excuse me, Representative Peterson.
Chairman, Representative, in our packet is a letter from somebody with a title from the National Physician Center of Executive Board.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, I'll
look at that if you'll please, and then
certainly
give us your thoughts.
I haven't seen this.
Okay.
Representative Peterson, are you referring to the one from Dr. Karen Ephraim?
Yes.
Okay.
And I would ask for a response, but I thought let them have a chance to read it first. And
appreciate that, Representative Peterson. Any other questions while they're perusing the letter? Did you have additional people to testify, Representative Paul?
Yes, I do. I think I can address. I think probably both of us can address two main points of this letter. The first is about the first paragraph beginning with House File 1555, that addresses the quarantine issue. It was the department's wish to have two bills. And one bill addresses Chapter 12. That's my bill. The other bill being carried by Representative Jim Adler is House File 1507. That bill deals mainly with the quarantine language. However, it's been pointed out, and I think it's technically true, that Sections 18 and 19 of 2002 session law, if Representative Abler's bill, and make sure I get this right, if Representative Abler's bill were to not pass and mine were to pass, then the sunset language on those sections would...
The sunset would disappear.
Yes, the sunset would disappear. That's a concern for some people, and we acknowledge that, and I've directed the department, and they have agreed to work with those folks to try to work out those differences. But basically, it's our intent for my bill to work on Chapter 12, which is emergency response, and Representative Abler, Chapter 144, which deals with quarantines. As for the second I think I'll have Ms. Lighthizer address that.
Thank you. Ms. Lysak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question seems to be about use of health care facilities. And what was added in 04 and is included again this year is page 1, lines 24 and 25. We limited when we can use a licensed health care facility to say that it is only when other alternatives are not feasible. Without that language, then health care facilities would fall under the regular definition and would be available to be used at any time. So we try to put some more limitations around that so that it is only as after other alternatives are considered.
Commissioner, Representative Paul, I apologize if I missed your point, but what about the concern here of no definition of declared emergency and how that may or may not include health situations or emergencies?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner?
The language that is in this email talks about the isolation and quarantine provisions, and that does not is not triggered by the declaration of an emergency, because you may have one individual who arrives here on the plane or on a train or some other way where an emergency is declared. Let me start a new sentence. An emergency is declared when local resources are inadequate to respond to an event. And for one individual with an infectious disease, triggering an emergency would be a much larger response than would be needed and would start additional activities that aren't necessary. So the isolation and quarantine is not connected to the declaration of an emergency. That is correct.
Okay, so the answer I'm looking for is you're saying this does not apply.
Mr. Chair, the question is about the isolation and quarantine piece, and this bill, 1555, is about emergency response and all hazards.
And this, thank you, Commissioner, and this point of this email then therefore does not apply in from your perspective.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It would be appropriate for the isolation and quarantine House File 1507 discussion.
Okay. Thank you for that response, Mr. Chair. I know we have others who want to testify and may have other concerns, but did you have anything else, Representative Powell, before we
no, Mr. Chairman.
To those
thank you.
Who would like to testify against the bill?
We have some, Mr. Chairman, that are going to testify for.
Okay.
Okay. And I'll just have them come up one at a time.
That'd be just fine.
Very good. Thank you.
Oop, we may now have a question. Excuse me, well, Commissioner. Representative Anderson.
I'm bringing the witnesses forward.
Okay, we'll wait. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and you may proceed.
My name is Rena McManus, and I am here testifying today as legislative chair of the local public health association. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here today representing, as I've indicated, the Local Public Health Association, also the Association of Minnesota Counties, and the Metro Intercounty Association. Counties support the Department of Health's efforts to move forward toward an all-hazards approach to emergency response. Over the past 2 years, local public health departments have worked closely with their local emergency managers, local law enforcement, that includes sheriffs, chiefs of police, fire departments, and other key responders to ensure that public health needs are addressed both during natural or man-made disasters. We have all learned that integrating public health protections and responses into our emergency plans add both value and depth to our all-hazards response system. We support the liability protection and limitation of tort action for volunteers as a way to encourage people to come forward as needed. County and local health resources are limited. We would need to solicit as much help as possible in the event of a widespread or long-lasting public health emergency. We recognize that individuals may have concerns about volunteering to help in such an event due to the risk of liability, and we don't want this to be a barrier to recruitment. Mr. Chairman, members, that concludes my formal remarks.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'll just wait until the rest of the testimony is taken.
Okay. Thank you. Any discussion or questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Representative Powell, did you have anyone else?
I do have one thing I do want to bring up, and again, it's about Section 18 and 19. Session law in 2002 was set to expire. There were 21, I believe. I believe it was 21 sections. They were set to expire in August of 2004. In 2004, the sunset was extended for another year to 2005. And I think what the opposition will tell you when they come up, I think, is probably technically correct. But in my bill, and if you look at the last page, on page 8, on line 15, you'll see that sections 18 and 19 are not slated to expire now, that if this bill passes, they would stay in force. When you look at sections 18 and 19, they do deal with isolation and quarantine of persons in 18. And in 19, deals with, and I can't find it right now, there it is, due process for isolation or quarantine of persons. So I think that's the nub of most of the disagreement, and I'll say it again as I said before. The Department of Health has told me that before this bill makes its next stop, that they will work with those who are opposition to the bill on that point and try to see if they can work out an agreement.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
To that point, Representative Powell, would you be willing to add 18 and 19 back in as a point of part of that line of numbers to be sunsetted?
Representative Powell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, it would be my, what I would hope would happen is that between now and the next stop, that the department, who I think has some concerns about those, and those who are concerned about that, could get together and reach some sort of an agreement. I'd like to have them get together first. I will tell you that as you look at the document you have in front of me, this was a confusing and very technical draft that the revisor had came up with. And I don't think, personally, that the department fully realized the problems that they may encounter with 18 and 19. And it was pointed out, it's been pointed out in a couple of the previous committees, and I think that the department is willing, now that they fully understand exactly what this little glitch is, I think they're willing, without any promises being made, but I think they're willing, before this goes to civil law, to see if they can come to some sort of accommodation. And with my conversations with the department, I'm hopeful that that will happen. So it would be my preference that that be left alone for now, so give the parties a chance to negotiate this.
So, Representative Powell, could we move on to those who have concerns with this?
Certainly.
Okay. Twyla Braze, President of Citizens Council on Healthcare. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record. You may proceed.
Thank you, Twyla Braze, Citizens Council on Healthcare. And we are definitely concerned about some of those sections that were discussed in the bill. And I have something here, if there's a page. What I did was I took the 2002 language and superimposed Representative Powell's bill on top of it, because if you look at the last page of 1555, you'll see that parts of it sunset and parts of it do not. But you cannot actually see in the bill what you're allowing to become what you're allowing to become permanent policy, and what you're actually sunsetting. So when you get a copy of the bill, essentially it's the bill as we would have liked the bill to have looked, so that you would all actually know what you were doing when you were making a vote on this. Then you will see that everything that is italicized and in bold is what was passed in 2002 and will become permanent policy. And one of those is 18 and 19, which is, I think, on page like 9 or 10 of our version of the bill. And I believe it starts on 7. It starts on 7, and all of that isolation and quarantine is what would become now permanent policy. What you need to understand from 2002 is that this bill actually came out of conference committee, and the House defeated it. Out of conference committee, the House defeated it. And part of the reason why it defeated it was because the quarantine and isolation piece, as well as some confiscation of property. So it had to go back to the conference committee, and it's really only because of the sunset that it actually passed. So now what is being done here in the health department's bill is to actually eliminate that sunset. And until you got what I've just provided for you, you weren't even sure probably what was being eliminated and what was being kept. So our concern is that Chapter 144, which is Section 18 and 19, is quarantine and isolation. And it has nothing to do with bioterrorism. It has nothing to do with the declared emergency. And the temporary hold piece of that in Section 19 allows the health department to detain someone, to walk into their home, take them out without a court order whatsoever or any judicial review. And so for the first 24 hours, they can be detained without a court order. By that time, the court order has to be sent in, and then there's another 24 hours before the court even has to rule. This is ongoing, all-the-time authority. And what the health department has said to this point is that they wanted to have these in two different bills, and we would like to make that true. We would like to have 18 and 19 put back into the sunset and let the discussion be in Representative Ayler's bill where it can be cleaned, because Representative Ayler's bill is the only bill that actually looks and has the language in front of you as legislators so that you even know what you're doing. Furthermore, our concern is about the healthcare facilities, which is on the first page of Representative Powell's bill. And then you have to go to our version of the bill and look on page 2, line 7, medical supplies. So our version of the bill, medical supplies. This is language you don't see in the Powell bill. And what we made very clear in there had to do with the fact that it says here, on line 9, a healthcare provider that materials are things that a healthcare provider deems not essential for the continued operation of a provider's practice or facility. Now, if the provider in that case becomes the state because they commandeer the building, then the protection that we got in the medical supplies language no longer holds. So we would like that language as well taken out, so that it protects people. Actually, I'll just say, because you're all from different areas of the state, the state could commandeer Grand Rapids Hospital, for instance, and decide that all the supplies or lots of them had to go down to Abbott Northwestern, leaving the Grand Rapids area without the necessary supplies to take care of their own people who are regularly having heart attacks and strokes and everything else that need to be taken care of. So that's why we put the protection language in 2002, and we see this as getting around that protection language. So those are our concerns.
Questions for Ms. Reyes? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Reyes, I guess I was wondering if you had any comments or had seen the letter we had gotten from a physician who talked about how some of these provisions would compromise medical ethics. All right. I was interested if you had a thought on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, is this the one from Dr. Karen Ephraim?
Yes.
And I have not seen this. However, that is a concern of ours, that when a hospital is commandeered by the state, at that point the state could perhaps tell physicians what kind of medical decisions that they needed to make. And they could perhaps direct nurses, and they could decide the respirator. They could decide who would get the respirator, how many respirators a hospital could keep, how many they had to ship to another hospital. We don't know what kind of power, but the fact that they could actually be a facility that they could commandeer might mean that they could control the practitioners as well as control what kind of supplies stayed with the facility.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Samuelson.
Mr. Chair, I actually have a question for Representative Powell.
Okay.
Shall I go ahead? Representative Powell, or Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, I was wondering where you're at with doing any merging of the two bills, yours and Representative Akers, and would it make sense to look at this as a whole versus just part, your part and their part?
Representative Powell. Mr. Chairman, Representative Samuelson, I think that's what the department, I think, wisely has tried to stay away from. They've been wanting to, and I think the purpose was, is to take the emergency response that we find in Chapter 12 and deal with revision of that in one bill, mine, and the quarantine and isolation, which Representative Abler has, and dealing with that in a separate bill and not trying to confuse the two. However, because of the way the revisers apparently had to draft the bill, I will fully admit that we do have, within my bill, some isolation, quarantine, and those types of, we do have some issues with that. But putting them together, I don't think the department would want to do that as a department bill. I would rather that they both remain separate, and I think that if the department and folks like Ms. Blaze could get together, we may be able to accomplish that.
Representative Sammons.
Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, I think it makes good sense then to keep the two separate because one really is dealing with a major emergency for the other one under a quarantine. It's a little bit different situation generally.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Powell, is there... I was given notice last week about amendments to take things out of the bill,
mm-hmm.
and it was agreed at that time that we wouldn't necessarily require trees to be cut because it would be simple, and it wasn't clear in the bill exactly what is happening anyway, and I see that point now. What is the concern with taking these provisions out of the bill and letting the department negotiate on that basis? And before something's put in that would be agreed to, given that it appears that there'd have to be a change anyway. Representative Powell.
Mr. Chairman, I would prefer if the department would speak to that.
Okay.
So we call them back up.
Welcome again, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I can be clear on your question. It's the question about the isolation and quarantine. Provisions, is that true?
Yes, Commissioner, the provisions that are being objected to, that in arguments being made that really shouldn't apply to this bill, and I guess what my question is, given that there's objections to it by, I know, some committee members who may be making a motion here to delete certain provisions of this bill, my question is why we wouldn't take them out, why it's a concern to take them out, and then let you folks negotiate with Ms. Braze, and I assume the family council as well, because they're on the list here to testify with concerns, why that wouldn't be a better situation to just let you folks negotiate before something gets put back into the bill, given that it'd probably be different anyway.
Okay. Mr. Chair, as Representative Powell described, our intent with having two bills was to be talking about Chapter 12, which is response to emergencies, in one bill and one discussion, and a separate bill and a separate discussion around the isolation and quarantine provisions. Because the two concepts were put together in one bill in 02 and continued with a sunset to 04 and then continued again to a sunset 05, in working with the revisor's office and trying to understand how to manage the removal of the sunsets or the changing of the sunset so that if one bill... It would depend to some extent on which bill passed first, which language prevailed, and their advice to us was to manage it the way we currently have it, which is not how we started. And it has been confusing for us and confusing for everyone that we've been involved with. So that's kind of how we got to where we are. Their advice is to try to manage it through the session to balance the two bills out together so that we're ending up with one not canceling out the other unintentionally. But I'm sure I can help clarify it because it's a confusing, more technical aspect.
Well, the concern that I hear, Commissioner, though, is that the concerns with this provision are quite serious in nature, and if it goes out of here, that will reflect the will of this body, and members will have to speak to it if the motion in fact is made, and we'll see what happens. But I just thought that should give you a chance to address that.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lighthouser, the mention was by Ms. Braze that she would like to see in the Section 2 the language deleted in Subdivision 4D. What are your feelings about that? It's on the front page of the Bill 1555.
Oh.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, as I mentioned earlier, this language was put in place to limit, if you will, the government's authority to be able to take a licensed healthcare facility, because without that, the healthcare facilities would be included in the definition of facility. This means that we would only consider a hospital or a nursing home if no other alternatives are feasible. So if we take that, if the language is taken out, then that sort of expands healthcare facilities as an option.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Paul?
Yes, I think if you looked at this and put a period after the word resident and then read the whole subdivision there, 4D, as a whole, then you would find that current law does allow the Department of Health to go in and take over a facility really just on a whim. At least the new, if I'm mistaken here.
But not on a whim.
Well, not on a whim. Excuse me. But I think that including this does clarify when it can happen, and that's when other alternatives are not feasible. And I think that is actually stronger language that is there right now.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to hear some more testimony as to the reason for taking the language out, if there's more.
Okay. Mr. Tom Pritchard with the Minnesota Family Council. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Pritchard. State your name for the record and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and a couple concerns we would raise. We would support taking out that language and keeping the bills truly clean and then going at it from that standpoint. The second concern we have, and I just raise it, and it probably can be dealt with, is on Sections 8, 10, and 11, which are being dropped out. They deal with... We were quite involved back in 2002 when this legislation first came forth. It was kind of a response, obviously, to 9/11 and the threat of bioterrorist attacks, which I think are obviously still with us. But those provisions were put in because the previous law was pretty wide open in terms of the governor's power to pretty much do any and everything. And those provisions, I think it's something we just need to look at, taking out the legislative oversight and involvement. And I think those are pretty key at the time that legislation was passed, and I see that those are being sunset, so I just raise that as a concern. So that would be a concern, and also we would support what has already been stated about the quarantine, taking those areas out. So thank you.
Questions for Mr. Pritchard?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Powell.
Thank you. In response to that, Mr. Pritchard is right, correct, that there is less legislative oversight as a result of this. I've discussed that with the department and with Ms. Braze, actually. I believe that there probably could be some middle ground there. But,
Representative Paul,
to add one more thing. We're looking at an all-hazards approach here, and that means that's why public health emergency has been taken out. The approach is that a tornado in St. Peter or a flood in Rosso can be a declared emergency just as a terrorism attack, that they would be treated basically under the same rubric. And it really helps with those emergency managers and those that respond to those to be able to respond in an integrated and consistent way. In addition, I don't think that we need to have the legislature here when we do have a tornado in St. Peter necessarily, or a flood in Roseau. But if we do have a very large event, it may be that the legislature would want to be here. And my thought on middle ground on that would be perhaps the governor would consult with, for instance, the president of the Senate and the speaker of the House, or something such as that. And again, that is something that I believe that we can work out as this thing progresses through the committee structure to get some language that really actually makes the bill better.
Questions for Mr. Pritchard? Thank you, Mr. Pritchard.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to...
Representative Anderson.
If I could just go ahead and do an oral amendment by adding 18 and 19, those two concerns by the testifiers to line 15 on page 8, and then delete the language in section subdivision 4D on the front page. I'd like to make that an oral amendment.
Okay, we can go to amendments. There's no one else to testify, as I understand it. Correct, Representative Paul?
Mr. Chairman, I have nobody else. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, Representative Anderson, could you restate your amendment solely, please, for the staff?
On page 1.
And members?
Subdivision 4D, lines 24 and 25, delete. That new language. And on page 8, line 15, add sections 18 and 19. That's on the quarantine language.
Okay, go back to page 1, Representative Anderson, if you would, please.
Lines 24 and 25.
Line 24 and 25.
Delete
the new language.
Correct.
Is that correct? Okay. And then on page 8, line 15.
Add sections 18 and 19.
After 11?
After 11. I have to take out the word and, I believe.
So we're going to delete the word and.
Put a comma after 11 and add 18 and put the word and back in between 18 and 19.
Insert comma 18 and 19.
Correct.
Does everyone have that amendment?
Chair.
Representative Paymar.
I just have a question to either Representative Powell or Representative Anderson, right. Maybe. In the bill, am I reading this wrong, that the sections 1, 2, 5, 8, 10, 11 are going to expire this year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, that is correct.
So then the amendment is to include, that's not correct?
No, that is correct.
Oh, I was looking at staff and I thought she was...
Perhaps I could just clarify that it's sections 1, 2, 5, 8, 10, and 11 of the 2002 bill that will expire, not of this bill.
Not of this bill, right. Okay. And then, but Representative Anderson's amendment includes section 18 and 19 of the 2002 bill.
That is correct. Mr. LePay?
That will expire in 2005.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And so, Representative Anderson, are you saying, and I'm sympathetic, in terms of civil liberties, to your intent here, but I'm just wondering, do you see the threat to this country in a different light today than you did maybe 2 years ago? Are things, do you see that there's less of a threat to this country of some kind of bioterrorism that's going to happen in August?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. Representative Paymar, to say there's going to be less of a threat, is that what you're asking?
Mr. Chair, you're asking.
Paymar.
I'm trying to get at your motivation for wanting those sections of current law to be sunset in August. I mean, somehow, has Al-Qaeda decided that they're going to enter into a truce with the United States? Are we under... Have things globally changed to satisfy you that this summer we don't need to have this bill? Have this law?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, each day is different. Every time I go to the guard base and listen to my intelligence, it's a different story, a different thing. Things we're much more prone to listening to the people, and we're seeing more people involved in security and intelligence and having a hand on the, and having a sense of what is going on more so since 9/11 than we have in the past. Not saying that there isn't a threat out there, not diminishing anything in a way of that area there, but we have a much greater awareness of the need for looking at things that are out of the ordinary, things that we may not in the past have considered to be a security threat, but to say now that maybe there could be a possibility of anything. But who knows? I mean, I'm not trying to diminish anyway that, but I'm just saying that we have a much greater handle on that, and I think that we should leave the bill, the sunset that we had in place from the 2002 language, at least those sections that were supposed to be back in the bill that we now are looking at, or at least put them back in there. 1819 were an original language to sunset, and to put them back in there would leave it as the language was coming forward from 2002.
To the amendment, Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the first point on page one, the amendment where we're deleting the new language about the facilities, I would say that we can do that, but I don't think the nursing homes will be very happy about it, but it's up to the committee. The committee's will be fine. I think it's more restrictive the way that the language is it appears in my bill, but it's up to the committee. On the second part, I just would say that by deleting 18 and 19, that if Representative Abler's bill also was to fail, then the department will have far fewer tools to use in case of a terrorist attack, smallpox, whatever. If those should occur, the department will have fewer tools to use. So I think that I certainly respect the civil liberty argument on this. I think that the commissioner and I have chatted about it, and we'll just leave it up to whatever the committee wants to do. But we just want to make sure that you understand there could be some ramifications for changing the language.
Representative Powell, with all due respect, you're in an important position, and you have a good background for carrying this bill. I'm sure you can understand that the question before the committee is not related to the Representative Abler's bill, but actually to the fact of whether or not this committee supports that provision. That's why I was asking that question earlier, and I'll just bring it up right now, because I think that's important to clarify for the committee members. It's difficult to consider something with regard to whether or not another bill passes, but we need to consider whether or not the committee supports this position.
And Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, and it was because of, again, the difficulty in drafting the bills and the way that they were presented to you that makes this thing difficult to follow and not very transparent. It has been my intent throughout this to make sure that everybody is aware that is what we're trying to do, and that's why you've got the handouts that you've got, and I just wanted to make sure that everybody knew what we were doing, and we were aware that this issue was going to come up. And if the Anderson Amendment, Representative Anderson Amendments goes on, then we will just move on and consider it a better bill as we go through the process.
We appreciate your being forthright, Representative Powell. Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Powell, I'm not going to let you get away with it. This is your bill, and it sounds to me like this amendment weakens what you're trying to do. And if that's the case, I would like to have you tell me that, because I'll vote against the amendment. It's your bill. You're the author. Does it strengthen it or weaken it? Because I think for what you're trying to do, it needs to be as strong as possible. And don't be too nice.
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson. I'll say it again. I think that if this amendment goes on, that they will take some tools out of the toolbox for the Department of Health if certain events were to happen. And I'll just leave it at that. And does it weaken them in that aspect? Yes, it does.
Further questions? Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to reaffirm what Representative Paul said in regarding weakening the toolbox, and I feel that if we are ever struck with a case of emergency that this bill address, that we need everything we can get, and I would support the bill. I'm sorry, I would vote the amendment.
Representative Paul, for clarification, and I'm not meaning to avoid your question, but for clarification, instead of a general statement of weakening or strengthening, could you give us a scenario and then what the amendment means for and the kind of tool that will be missing and if the amendment goes down, what it means for your bill, what your bill means?
If possible. I'm going to turn that over to the department. The department has worked for quite some time with local agencies to change 2002 session law. And I think that the changes that they've come up with, by and large, are stronger because of the bottom-up process that's been going on. And I think, to give you good examples, I could probably speak on it, but if you want a definitive answer, I think the assistant commissioner would do a better job.
Commissioner.
Well, Mr. Chair, in regards to the two parts of the amendment, as I said, currently, without the proposed language on lines 24 and 25, that allows the governor to use any facility that he chooses during an emergency. The language on 24 and 25 limits when he can use a licensed health care facility. And so that language on lines 24 and 25 was added at the request of the nursing home industry last session, and we proposed it again this year. The addition of 18 and 19 to the sunset provision, currently what was passed by the 04 legislature sunsets all the provisions, all the changes to Chapter 12 and the changes to 144, which is the isolation and quarantine provision. Putting 18 and 19 into this language continues sort of the current approach, which is that the isolation and quarantine due process descriptions would not be continued after August 1st if Representative Abler's bill doesn't pass, and I appreciate the complications of having two bills to try to follow and to understand. The sort of process challenge is depending on whether Representative Powell's bill passes first or Representative Abler's bill passes first. If this language is in there, it's more of a complicated process. I think the question is the intent of the committee to remove the provisions around isolation and quarantine and have them expire in August of 05 as the current law as it happened. Our recommendation from the Department of Health and the administration is that the description and the protections and the process that's outlined in the isolation and quarantine provisions are important and need to be continued. So to the extent that this would sunset those provisions in August of 05, I would speak against it.
Commissioner, when Twyla Brace spoke from Citizens Council on Healthcare, she referenced a document. Can you concur as to which page and provisions the section 18 and 19 represent?
Mr. Chair, I didn't get a copy of her language, but it would be the... It would be starting on page...
I thought it was on page 7.
Page 7, section 18, middle of the page. Minnesota Statutes 144.419, and then goes on through... page 11, again about the middle of the page, right before where it says section 20.
Commissioner, what I'm struggling with is I'm hearing a lot of general statements. And what specifically will be your objection to having this language sunsetted this August? A tool in the toolbox is gone, yes. But what does all this language really do for you?
Mr. Chair, the language in Section 18 and 19 describes how the Commissioner would use the authority that's been with the Department of Health for over 100 years. There's a general language in Chapter 144 that says the Commissioner can isolate and quarantine. What Sections 18 and 19 do is describe the process of how that would be applied. It provides for when the court orders need to be taken, the timelines under which it occurs, the conditions under which a person in isolation or quarantine can be held, requires that the Commissioner use the least restrictive means necessary to accomplish the ends. It says that the provisions are only to be used for a new or novel or bioterrorism agent that is infectious, that is passed person to person, and for which isolation and quarantine can be effective. It describes the appeal process that an individual in isolation and quarantine has if they believe that they're being held inappropriately or that the conditions are not according to statute. It provides for judicial oversight and involvement. It sort of lays out all of the specific steps in the process that is used when a person is ordered to isolation and quarantine and they don't agree with it. Our first tool in the toolbox is persuasion and information. And this is the sort of the fallback provision if someone does not agree with the recommendations and wants and does not want to follow the provisions. This is the process that is laid out that we would then use.
Thank you for bearing with me on the extended question, Commissioner. Ms. Braze, I'm trying to connect your concerns with what is being presented here and understand very clearly, because when I listen to your concerns, I very, very quickly felt concerned about what we're doing, but as I struggle to hear exactly what this does from the Commissioner and the concerns or her position and Representative Powell's, I'm not connecting it. Can you help us a little bit?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, first of all, the important thing to understand is this is not about an emergency. This is ongoing authority, and if you look at the language that I provided you with, you will see certain things that have to do with what is communicable, and there's words like believed to be, or they can be quarantined if there's a likelihood of. And so individuals, it doesn't have to be based on a fact that they actually know something, but individuals can be isolated and quarantined any time of the year, no declaration of emergency, no judicial review, no court order. What the department, I think, was trying to say when they talked about general authority already currently in statute, there is a temporary emergency hold in 144.4182, and that one requires a court order. Now, if the, you know, this whole thing is being talked about as though it's going to be some major emergency, and our point is to say that this is ongoing, unaccountable for type of authority where nobody has to be notified. In fact, somebody could be told that they're going to be put into quarantine and so therefore they won't be put into quarantine if they get vaccinated, if they get treated, if they get tested. And in fact, no one would even have to ever know and no court order would ever have to be given and there would be no public document whatsoever before if that person actually agreed to do what the health department wanted. Under the threat of quarantine and isolation, because the temporary hold section of Section 19 in the document that I gave you, that temporary hold section says they don't have to get a court order for 24 hours, and then there doesn't have to be a ruling for another 24 hours. So if this committee is going to support the quarantine and isolation provision, they should support it with a court order, not with the temporary hold position, which allows them to just take people without anybody else knowing about it. So the other thing is that the CDC themselves says that you don't need 100% compliance the CDC Centers for Disease Control. You don't need 100% compliance. In Toronto, they had more than 90% compliance, and the few that didn't comply, they got a legal order. They got a court order. But the temporary hold provision in 19, there is no court order. And besides that, in the last two committees, the health department has emphatically stated, even without being asked, that they have two separate bills going forward, one about 144 and the quarantine isolation, and the other about, because that's ongoing, it's a different type of authority, and one about emergency management during the declared emergency. And so now to hear them say that they want to have it in both bills is for them to say something different than they originally claimed was their intent. And I think it's very difficult for any committee to have a bill come forward without even knowing what the language is that you're approving. And the language is, for the most part, not all, but for the most part, there in the Abler bill. And therefore, the committee could actually see it. Now, because I have provided you with something, you actually can kind of see the language. But the point here is that it should be a clean bill. It should be what the department had intended in the beginning. And you should understand this is not about emergencies. This is about ongoing, unreportable type activities that the health department can do.
Thank you for that clarification. Any questions to the amendment? Did you have anything to add, Commissioner? I agree with one thing, Representative Powell. This is very complicated.
I appreciate that, and it is. And I readily admit much of what Ms. Bray says is true about the construct of the bill. And I don't believe that it was the intent of the department to get the two bills confused by, you know, having 18 and 19 being hung out there. But it was, again, the way that the reviser did it, and apparently, in my investigation, that was the only way it could be done. And that's where we're sitting, and it is confusing. I still don't understand why it had to be written up that way, but that's what they told me.
Representative Powell, what Ms. Braze has identified, I'm beginning to see in the bill on page 10, subdivision 2, the commissioner, right at the beginning, may by directive isolate or quarantine, and I understand from Ms. Braze that this doesn't apply to emergency situation.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Yeah. She's right about that.
Yeah. That we,
and because that's in 144, which is quarantine in that section. Mine is just about emergency response. That's true.
And I'm trying to see exactly how this could affect a local government. That's what I'm really looking for, because that's really our jurisdiction. Representative Pimar. Seeing no further questions or discussion, the Representative Anderson motion before us to delete the new language on page 1, lines 24 and 25, and also on page 8 to add sections 18 and 19. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Nobody likes to test my hearing. Representative Powell.
I renew my pledge that the department will work with Ms. Brace to try to fix this thing, because I think there's some middle ground on several of these issues, and we'll work with her on it.
Thank you, Representative Powell. I think members on both sides of the issue would probably appreciate that. Amendment. I have a 0312 amendment. Anybody want to claim that? Do we have an author to the 05-0312? Representative Powell?
Hold that up so I can see it. I don't think I... Is Does it have? Does it insert the word elderly?
That is correct.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mr. That is my amendment, and I forgot to pick it up.
Okay.
This was, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Powell.
This amendment is in response to concerns. Again, Ms. Brace brought up in local government, and we told them at that committee at the time that we would bring this forth as an author's amendment when we came before your committee. I apologize for forgetting it, and I forgot it. So,
Representative Powell. Representative Peterson moves the AO5-0312 amendment be adopted to House File 1555. Any further points, Representative Paul?
Mr. Chairman, other than we like this amendment and like to see it go on to the bill.
Discussion to the amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of the Peterson motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. To the bill as amended. Is there anybody that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Peterson renews his motion that House Bill 1555 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is that the bill is passed and be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee.
Thank you, Representative Powell and Commissioner and those who testified. Next bill on the agenda is House File 701, Senate File 471. Representative Blaine. I understand we're going to move the Senate language, Representative Blaine?
That would be fine.
Yeah. And this goes to the General Register.
That would be even more fine.
Did you have some place you thought it needed to go?
More fine. No, that would that works for me.
Okay. Representative Blaine, I will move that House Senate File 471. Be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. To your bill, Representative Blaine.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members for the tape, Representative Greg Blaine, District 12B, Morrison, Colon Counties. Senate File 471 or House File 701 makes a modest change to Minnesota's Regional Development Act to authorize regional development commissions to play a role in developing affordable housing in greater Minnesota. In my part of the state, the Region 5 Commission, with its office in Staples, is looking to play a key role in the development of affordable housing in our north-central Minnesota region. The Regional Commission would help find properties appropriate for housing development and secure clear title to these properties. They would then work with local and regional housing authorities who will actually bring the resources to bear to build the affordable housing units. The Regional Commission has been playing a role in trying to foster affordable housing and has found that statutory limitation on their authority to own property is an impediment to playing the role that they can most appropriately play in helping meet affordable housing needs. This bill simply expands the region's authority for this particular purpose. I've met with Bob Hutton, who is right here with me at the table from Region 5 Development Commission, and he is willing to expand that knowledge base to the committee members here, and would certainly support the committee's support on this. This same language passed on the Senate side through two committees with no dissenting votes. So, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I would like to have Mr. Hutton say a few words.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hutton. State your name and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bob Hutton. I'm the Executive Director of the Region 5 Development Commission in Staples. And I'm going to be very brief. Region 5 Development Commission is devoted to assisting local governments and development organizations and community leaders in central Minnesota who are working to improve their communities and build decent, safe, and affordable homes specifically. The mission of the Housing Department is to assist local communities, again, in preserving, creating, and developing decent, safe, affordable housing as it relates to both single and multifamily units. And also as it becomes a stronger quality of life issue in Cass, Crow Wing, Morrison, Todd, and Wadena counties. We basically have two programs in which we would like to have more specific language in the bill. The first one is our affordable housing program, which uses Department of Corrections crews called ICWC built, or Institution Construction Work Crew, crews to construct the homes. We also work with the Minnesota Housing Finance in that area. Our request is really in both the affordable housing, again, and the self-help housing program in which families build their own homes. The current wording of the Regional Development Act does not specifically describe the parameters within which regional development commissions can buy and sell property. Because the Act does not clearly define this activity, it has the potential to impede our ability to continue to provide affordable housing options for the residents of Greater Minnesota. I'm open to any questions that you may have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Questions? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I didn't get your name.
I'm sorry. Bob Hutton.
Bob Hutton. Mr. Hutton, does this now give you the wherewithal to something that you can't do? I mean, as far as you actually can now build affordable housing for the region or for the areas within the region, the cities, or whoever is requesting it from you?
Mr. Hutton. Mr. Chairman, Representative, currently we're interpreting the Regional Development Act in such a way to use Subdivision 3, which allows us to own property. It doesn't specifically state what that property can be used for. This bill allows us to own property, but it allows us to use it specifically for providing affordable housing in our region.
So, Mr.
Representative Anderson.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hutton, the money that you're using now or have available now, you can now redirect the funds to this expanded language in the bill? Is that what I'm gathering? That you can, you're getting funds now, you're going to expand the purpose of your funds to do more?
Mr. Hutton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we're going to continue to do the same thing that we're doing right now. We're operating in what I would call a gray area right now, and I would prefer that the language is specific so we can feel comfortable with what we're doing.
It's still probably
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Lane.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson and members, simply what this bill does is give us clarifying language. It's not stated in the language that the development commissions are using now specifically that monies can be used for affordable housing, although they have been using that practice already. But the reason the bill is here is we want to make sure that we have this language specified in law that it is okay to do that.
Further discussion to the bill. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. First of all, does this give eminent domain authority to these commissions?
Mr. Hutton?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't believe so. I'm not terribly clear on it. At least that's not the intent at all. We simply want to buy properties to resell them for affordable housing. And that's simply what we want to do.
Representative Holbrook, I think it's being looked up. Do you have a second question?
I do, and this might be for staff as well. On lines 11 and 12, it says, wherever located in the state, does that modify or change the authority of these commissions to go outside of their area as the bill's written?
Representative Blaine.
I believe that's existing law right now, but certainly Region 5 isn't looking to go outside of their five-county area to address needs because we have Region Development Commissions, you know, covering the state. And so I think it's their intent to work within their own development commission area.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if the way this bill is written, if that's clear that they're not allowed to go outside their area, or if that language in the bill, wherever located in the state, would open that up as a possibility.
Remember, Representative Blaine, this is the committee that deals with annexation.
Does that mean I should bring another bill, right?
Mr. Chair and members, I would be interested in our House Research's opinion on these two questions. I respect Representative Holberg's insight into this too.
Mr. Chairman, members, the current language includes the phrase wherever located in the state, and that would now modify not only property acquired for purposes of housing the administrative office of the regional commission, but also property acquired to facilitate the development of affordable housing. So, in a sense, it's existing law, but it would modify the new amendment as well, I believe.
Representative Holbrook.
Well, I'm not so sure I like that authority. Mm-hmm. And then I'd also am waiting for an answer on the eminent domain issue.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbrook, I was looking through the Regional Development Commission chapter, and I do not see any authority for use of eminent domain by a Regional Development Commission. So it would not include that as far as I can tell.
And just for clarification, if we pass this bill into law, it would not give that authority to them in any way.
Ms. Dice.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, no, I don't believe so.
Okay, good.
Mr. Hutton.
Mr. Chairman, members, are the makeup of the Regional Development Commissions are county folks, county commissioners, they're municipality folks, they're township folks, and I really can't see or ever perceive of a chance of us using eminent domain with that group.
Representative Holbert?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the ball's now in the author's court. I guess, I for one will vote no on the bill if it means that regional development commissions now have the authority to buy, lease, acquire, own, hold, improve, or use real personal property or interest in property wherever located in the state.
Representative Blaine, I've asked counsel if it would be easy to come up with some language to address Representative Holbrook's concern. Are you amenable to that? Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Holbrook,
maybe the rest of the committee doesn't care. That's fine too. But I don't really, as much as I like Section 5, I really don't want them coming down to Dakota County to move affordable housing initiatives.
Why? No, sorry, Representative McLean.
Mr. Chair and members, and certainly my good friend Representative Holbrook, I understand. I understand where you're going with this, and evidently what was written or was what is currently in statute now is probably, you know, here I'm coming to this committee to bring a bill to have clarifying language in what's already in statute above it is actually we're gonna fix that right now if it be the chairman and the committee's wish and I would be willing to hear from staff. I think we could add about three or four words to do that.
Representative Holbrook, staff does have an amendment if you'd like to address that.
I'd certainly move whatever solution they have.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think there are two possibilities. One would be to limit all of the authority to acquire property to the region by on line 11 striking the comma wherever located in the and on 12 strike state. Or alternatively, just limit the new authority to within the region, which would be on line 14, after opportunities, insert in the region.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move deletion of line 11, wherever located in the, and line 12, state. And my purpose, or my reason for choosing that alternative is I can't imagine a situation where the administrative office of the regional commission would be outside of their area.
Representative Holbrook moves on page 1, line 11, to strike the words wherever located in, comma, and wherever located in the, and on line 12, strike the word state. Is that correct?
This is modified.
Representative Blaine, it looks like we're going to try to improve current law as well, if it's considered an improvement by members. To the amendment, Representative Blaine.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm fine with the amendment.
Okay. To the amendment, discussion.
Mr. Chair, can I make one comment?
Yes, Representative Blaine.
I do see where this could be. Where this could pose a possible conflict in the future, if you had a development commission that was asked by a neighboring commission to help them in building affordable housing into their district, this would not allow that. And there may be instances where that may take place in rural regions of the state.
Representative Blaine, and for council, in a case like that, would not a joint powers agreement allow them to override this? Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, I think it's possible. I was just thinking through in the joint powers statute, there's a commonality of powers requirement where both entities entering into the agreement have to have powers in common, but then there are other subdivisions in that section that sort of eliminate that need, so I think it is a possibility.
Are you, Representative Blaine, are you comfortable going forward with this and looking for any problems later?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I am comfortable with that amendment, and I mean we'll have time between now and the floor if I have to readjust this. I will. Obviously, we're spending better time on this and certainly better mind power on this. This went through two committees in the Senate. They certainly didn't catch any of this. So,
Blaine, that's the Senate.
Yeah, I know. That's I just figured that out here too. So, I'm fine with this. I will continue to meet with Mr. Hutton on this. We want to, obviously, development commissions want to have this language clarified. You know, the underlying language of the bill to protect themselves in what the work that they're currently doing. I think in the long run we're going to be all right with this. So I would just soon see this moved.
Thank you, Representative Blaine. It's very consistent with the intents you've stated. Further discussion, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Glenn, I understand the spirit of the amendment here. I would hope that this language change would in no way take away from the possibility of different RDCs working together on cooperative agreements where two or more RDCs may wish to do something cooperatively. So as you work on this some more, I think it would be well for Mardo to weigh in on this to make sure that by doing this we're not tying the hands of cooperative agreements. I think all of us, this committee, I think would want to encourage cooperation among regional development commissions, not do things that would get in the way of cooperation.
To the amendment. See no further
He accepted the amendment. I don't know, are we going to vote on it?
Yeah. He's not a member of the committee.
Representative Holberg moves on page 1, line 11, okay. Strike the comma and words wherever located in the, and on line 12, strike the word state. Seeing no further discussion of the amendment, all those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay?
No.
No.
The motion prevails, the amendment is adopted. Thank you. To the bill as amended. Is there anyone that'd like to, anyone else that'd like to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion to pass House File, Senate File 471 as amended and be sent to the General Register. Signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay.
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is passed as amended and will be sent to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you.
Representative Thiessen, hoping we still have time for your bill. You've been at this stage before. I apologize
for
that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for getting that.
I've just been informed that we can go till 2:30 on Mondays, and members already should know that we have a meeting tonight, and while I'm talking about it...
What time tonight?
4:30. While I'm talking about it, our Wednesday meeting was canceled. We tried again, as I said, to set an agenda so everybody would know, but our Wednesday meeting was now canceled, so we're going to try to take up the whole agenda tonight, and we'll be going pretty late.
4:30.
Which one? Representative Thiessen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you have somebody move your bill? I'll move your bill.
Thank you.
I will move that House File 1365 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. To your bill, Representative Thiessen.
And, Mr. Chair, I also have an A3 and A4 amendment that maybe just to get the bill in shape, if we could. It's up to you, whatever your preference is.
A3 and A4, to get the bill in the order the author would like it?
Yes. And just briefly, Mr. Chair, do you want to move those first? Or
I'll move the A3 amendment, statute of limitations.
Okay, and this, just so members know, is we've been having discussions with some of the parties involved here, including the cities. This is a move to try to alleviate some of their concerns.
Okay.
So that's what, and I'll explain it more when we get there.
I'll move the A3 amendment again, and to get it in the order the author would like it. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. The A4 amendment, Representative Thiessen.
And that is also clarifying language that take care of some of the concerns of some of the interested parties. And I'll discuss that also as part of the whole.
Okay. I move the A4 amendment. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This legislation, 1365, is really about fairness, and we do have two witnesses who will describe kind of from their personal experience what the problem is that this bill is aimed to address. But just to briefly describe it, currently if a hauler, a garbage hauler, has built up a business, you know, over 10 or 20 years in a community, the city that that hauler is in can basically decree that that person, even if it's complying with all kind of safety and health standards, must go out of business without any compensation. That's the current state of the law. And what this bill simply does is it would provide some compensation for that hauler, for the business that they've built up over many years. Just a couple things about what it doesn't do, because there has been some confusion. First, eminent domain in a kind of constitutional sense only applies to real property. So if they take real property, it doesn't apply if they take a business. That's why we need to do this. Secondly, it doesn't prohibit a city from taking any action. It just requires compensation. So the city can continue to do everything they think is necessary in the public good. The third thing is that if there's currently a contract between the city and the garbage hauler, as opposed to where the garbage hauler in some cities contracts with individual residences and businesses, but if there's currently a contract between the city and the garbage hauler, this amendment or this legislation wouldn't apply. The contract terms would apply. It doesn't prevent the city from competing. It only prevents the city from prohibiting someone else from competing with them. So the city could get into the business and compete as a market participant without this, and drive that business out of, and drive that other business out of business with just by virtue of being a better competitor, and this statute wouldn't apply. And the third thing, or another thing, is that if there's criminal or fraudulent conduct by the hauler, the city can terminate their ability to participate in that market without any consequence under this statute. The basic philosophy here is that if a city is going to do something in the public good, you know, and there are circumstances perhaps where a city may make a decision to limit the number of haulers in a city, the question I think for the committee is should that the burden of that decision to benefit the public good rest on one single business that you're putting out of business, or should it rest on the people who are benefiting from the public good, which are the residents of the city? And I think it should kind of, that burden should be spread out and shouldn't be focused just on one business. So that's kind of just an overview. If I could have, if it would be okay with the chair, to have my two witnesses come up and tell a little bit about the situations they've seen.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Skoltman. I'm the general manager of Randy's Sanitation. We're a family-owned business based in Delano with locations in Burnsville and Rogers. We employ 135 people. This is a fairness issue in our mind. Our business was formed in 1979 by Randy and Sandy Wiskowiak, who, as a family of two, purchased a route from a friend of Randy's, and over the course of time built that route from scratch to be the size business it is today. And in the course of doing that, they purchased one truck and a route, made their payments to that individual because he was retiring. And 15 years later, they owned that route, and since then we've grown and support most of the western suburbs as well as some of the northern and southern suburbs now from a residential standpoint. When Randy and Sandy started their business, the days were long. They were 14 to 16-hour days, and they knew that if they worked hard that they could provide a service which would be fair to the customers and build a business for their family, hopefully for the future of their family, to both work at, prosper at, and retire at someday. We're doing some of that right now. We have five boys all employed at the business and a daughter who someday I think will be. And we clearly understand that we work in a highly regulated business that is very competitive, and we work very hard to build relationships, which is what our business is about. As a family-owned business, we don't own an incinerator or a landfill, and based upon that, we have to make our money, we have to make our profit on customer service. That's all we have to offer. So we work hard at that. We like doing that because we know that as a small company, we can react probably faster to changing market conditions over the course of time. And, you know, any customer that's not served well, we're there to pick up those pieces and try and prove to them that what they should be doing is working with the family-owned business. We feel competition is essential. We feel it improves service for the customers. We feel it stabilizes prices in the market, and we like to be there to do those things. We feel we can compete, not feel, we know we can compete with the national companies because of the things I've said, and we have no problem doing that every day, and I think our customers benefit from that. I look at our, we have a start-stop report, and I see the people would start and stop and the reasons why. And every day we match prices and we look for ways to provide better services. And our customers benefit from that. And that's good. But what we can't compete with really is the fact that a city or town could elect to come in tomorrow and for some reason decide that they wanted to take over the business and for whatever reason take our market share and give it to someone else. I'm going to give you an example of that. If a city would elect to do that, one of our cities is Maple Grove. We have about 4,000 customers in Maple Grove, and it's a community of 16,000 or more homes. If we were going to try and protect that investment for us, when we look at things, if we look at the money we put in, and I had the numbers put together, so I can tell you, we spend between $75 and $105 per customer to get that customer, and that would include from the time they call in, we route them into the system, we set them up in the computer, we buy the cart, we assemble the cart, we deliver the carts, and when all is said and done, before we've even served them, we have anywhere from $75 to $105 in that customer. The variance would be in whether or not we had to market them, and if we do have a marketing program which is in-house, we don't pay anybody to do it. If we had to give away some free months or something of that nature, it increases our costs. So in Maple Grove, we would have between $300,000 and $400,000 in those customers invested, and many of those customers we've had for 20 years. If tomorrow we had to bid on that community, if somebody said, you know what, we want one hauler for all 16,000 customers, and I had to go out and buy 12,000 carts and three trucks and employ men to do it, it would cost us over $1 million to do that, and that would happen within 6 months. Well, there's several problems. First of all, a company like ours grows right on the edge. We feel it's essential to grow because if you don't, the business will wither and die, and yet you have cash flow issues, so you grow as much as you can afford to grow. And one of the things that we have without organized collection is the ability to grow within our cash flow, within our means. And tomorrow, to protect that $400,000 investment, if I had to spend $1 million, and that's what it would cost, $560,000 in carts and $530,000 in trucks, if I had to spend over $1 million to protect that, I couldn't do it. We don't have the money sitting around that's above and beyond our growth dollars set aside to do that. So given the fact that we plan very carefully for those growth needs, if I couldn't bid for it, or if I did and didn't get it, I'd have to park the trucks I have, pull back in the carts that I have, lay off the person or two people I have doing that job, and then hopefully over the course of time put that equipment back to work. In a business like ours, there's not a lot of extra money at the end of the month. It goes into growing the business. It goes into providing good benefits for our employees and their families. So a bill like this is something. It's not just fair, it actually could put us out of business. Now, when Randy and Sandy bought their business and said, you know what, if we do things right, someday we're going to have a retirement account set aside for ourselves, and that's our business because we're going to sell this business to someone, to have it just taken away isn't fair. It isn't right, and it's certainly not what I would call American. We struggle, and I'm going to tell you that you're going to hear testimony here today, later by people that oppose this bill, that the main worry is how much is it going to cost us to put these people out of business, you know? And to me, I worry about going out of business. The tool in their bag right now is free, and so it's real easy to have that tool and want to have that tool for the future. Because what if we need it? You know what? It scares the heck out of me, because if they need it and if they use it, it puts us out of business. So there should be a cost associated with that, and I appreciate the fact that you've listened to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Stolman. Help me understand. You're in Maple Grove, so you're doing that without a contract.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson. That's correct.
And if I wanted to get in the business of Maple Grove, I can just get a truck and go up and down the street and solicit your customers.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Stolman.
Representative, that's correct. If you purchased a license, if they had licenses available.
Do you have a license in Maple Grove?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Stolman.
Representative, we do.
And that's not a contract?
No, that's not.
So it has no stipulation as to required what day you carry, what streets you drive on.
It does, Mr. Chair, Representative, it does have stipulations in it as to the fact that we pick up on certain days and have to provide certain levels of service. Certainly there is
and are there
conditions.
Are there some, are there some streets in Maple Grove that you cannot solicit business on? Is it geographic specific?
Mr. Stone, Mr. Chair, Representative, no, it's not. We can pick up the entire community. Okay. Representative Peterson.
That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Stone? Okay. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Don Williamson. I'm from Wilmer, Minnesota, and I'm the owner of West Central Sanitation. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just a brief illustration. I know your time is important. I'm sure all of us around this table share the American dream of owning a home. We're probably making payments on those homes today. And it'd be a terrible thing if 20 years from now or 25 years from now, when we're ready to pull back and retire, that we lost our home and we weren't to get paid for it. And we just lost it, couldn't live in it, couldn't enjoy it, and not even get paid to lose it. Wouldn't it be even worse if you bought that home, made payments on it for 3 or 4 years, and then lost it, still had to pay for it for another 20 years? That'd be a terrible situation. It doesn't sound fair. It's not fair, and I think it's unreasonable. And yet, put my business in the place of your home, and that's what my experience has been in this last year. A year and a half ago, I purchased Olson Dre from Granite Falls. It was owned by Dan Olson, family-owned company. He had owned it for 11 years, and he had bought it from Roy Lenson, which was mayor of Granite Falls for over 20 years. Maybe some of you remember his name. Mr. Lenson had been in the garbage business when garbage business became a business. So he owned his business for over 30 years and established it. When he had cancer, he sold it to Dan Olson, and Dan had it for 11. Dan had a family problem, so we bought it a year and a half ago. Everything went fine. We kept all the same employees, and we were happy to make that purchase and that investment in that community in Yellow Medicine County. And then what happened is about a month into it, 2 weeks to a month into it, a small town by the name of Echo, which had never had an ordinance governing trash at all, not even if they should use cans or not, and that was one of the communities that we were servicing, and Olson had serviced for 11 years, and Mr. Lenson had serviced for over 25 years, decided to put ordinances on garbage collection. Came out of nowhere. It happened so fast that we weren't even told about it. We didn't get a chance to address it until it was already started, and it was on the way through. They put ordinances governing the garbage collection, decided that it would become the city's responsibility, decided to organize that collection, and then gave the contract to a young man close to town, which is fine. He bought a truck and got in the garbage business. Now, I don't have any trouble competing. That's what we do. All of us in business compete every day, and that's a fine form for our cities and for our government, for us as businesses to compete, But what I did have a problem with, they didn't bid the community. They didn't ask anyone else to bid. They wouldn't, they listened to me, but they wouldn't address my concerns that I had just purchased this business. I asked if there were any problems with our service, and they said absolutely none. I said, we haven't raised prices, and prices hadn't been risen for over 10 years. I said, so what is the issue? They said, well, it's just important for us to control the garbage now. I let them know that we complied with the county solid waste plan, that we continued to deliver their trash to Lyon County, as always had been the situation. We had promised to continue to do that, and we had never broken that promise. They said, well, that wasn't the issue. We were still collecting the recyclables and taking them and processing them like they had wanted. That wasn't the issue. The issue was they wanted to control the trash, and I wasn't going to be the garbage hauler. And I, as much as I tried in talking to the city councilman and so forth, I think they liked me, but that wasn't good enough. They were going to control it. So I lost that town, and that's the first time I've ever lost the privilege to serve, and it kind of hurt. Hurt a lot. What hurts worse is I'm the stupid guy that gets to pay for it for the next 14 years. I don't get to enjoy it. I don't get to serve my customers. And I could bring in for you, it's a small community, about 102 homes. I know that's small. But I live in fear if it would happen in a larger community, I'll tell you that. I could not sustain that blow. But I could bring in to you 54 letters of customers that have said to me, we don't know why you're not able to haul our trash anymore, Don. We don't understand it. You were doing a great job. Same drivers that have been doing it for years. And we don't understand what happened in our city, but we don't agree with it. But it's too late for that community. And so with no violations, No ordinances whatsoever until that time. No bidding opportunity for me to retain that business or even to compete for it. The city pushed me out of business. I would ask you to support House File 1365. I think it's reasonable, and I think it speaks to fairness in our system. Thank you.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Williamson, when you said the county wanted control of the garbage, was that to a particular facility, or the city wanted control?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Williams.
Representative Hornstein. It wasn't the county, sir. The city decided they wanted to control the garbage collection and operation in their community.
Okay, but it wasn't to a particular facility, because that would violate a Supreme Court
Mr. Williams.
Rule. Mr. Chair, that didn't even come into the question, which was ironic. That wasn't the issue.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Further questions?
On the author? Or
from the testifier. Thank you for your testimony. Now questions to the... Or do you have additional testimony?
I don't have any other testimony.
Okay, we have three others on the list that would like to testify before we... Okay, you want to wait? All right, thanks. I'll call forward Bill Haney of Minnesota Resource Recovery. Then I have Rick Moskwa, the City of Red Wing, and Craig Johnson, League of Cities. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please, and you may proceed.
My name is Rick Moskwa, and I'm a Deputy Director of the City of Red Wing Waste Energy Facility, and with me is Bill Haney with the Minnesota Resource Recovery Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before the committee. I'm here to testify against House File 1365. The City of Red Wing is proud of the fact that it has the oldest operating waste energy facility in the state. Our facility provides a local tannery with steam for processing. It is a small facility but can process about 20,000 tons of municipal solid waste each year. The City of Red Wing, through its Public Works Department, has provided garbage services to all residents, city residents since the 1940s. The city alone can only provide the facility with approximately 6,000 tons a year. The remainder of the waste must come from other haulers. Recently, the local private hauler providing commercial business with services sold his hauling company and trucks to waste management. Prior to the sale, the local hauler sent about 3/4 of the waste to the city. Now that the waste is brought to their landfills in Wisconsin or Minnesota, we don't have enough waste to run the facility. Over the last year and before the sale, the facility began to experience a drop in waste deliveries, not only from the local hauler, but other haulers in and around the city within Goodhue County. A loss of waste has recently resulted in the facility having to close on Wednesdays, and the tannery is then not able to receive its processing steam for the facility to operate. Facility combined with the tannery, along with their parent company, Red Wing Shoe Company, employs over 1,200 employees in Red Wing. Both entities are in jeopardy if this continues. After careful consideration, the City Council and workshop setting asked the City Attorney and staff to prepare a plan to implement organized collection of commercial accounts within the city limits following the statutory requirements for such collection, including a 180-day process. The City is also working closely with Goodhue County to increase waste deliveries. The City is taking these and other steps to protect its investment in the waste-to-energy facility, as well as the ash landfill serving the facility, which combined represent a total investment of the city in excess of $12 million. The closing of the Red Wing facility will place additional tax burden related to funds required to close the facility and its landfill. House File 1365, if adopted, would place the city at tremendous financial risk, as there are a number of private haulers who collect from commercial businesses in the city, including a hauler from Wisconsin who takes the waste to a transfer station and ultimately a landfill in Wisconsin, since the tipping fee is less than at the facility. If the city organizes collection, one or more of these haulers may be displaced. Adopting House File 1365 would support haulers to continue to landfill in Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota. This is contrary to the state's preferred hierarchy for managing waste. Adopting House File 1365 effectively provides a monopoly to haulers currently in business, regardless of the level and quality of service, cost to constituents, public health, or
welfare concerns. Along with these concerns, the bill would allow a waste hauler that has old, unsafe, leaking trucks to potentially have a claim against the city that wants to take over collection to protect the health and welfare of the citizens. Same is true for cities that want to limit multiple haulers that are roaring through the city, collecting waste, adding additional axle loadings to their roadways. We would question what amount of damages would a hauler be entitled to. How would it be measured? Is it likely that it may be a large settlement to be borne ultimately by taxpayers? Because there is a possibility that organized collection could cost a lot. The effect is to limit and discourage cities from protecting the safety of their residents. Is this the intent of the bill? Waste haulers expect a highly regulated and licensed industry and not to be free of regulation. This would seem to be an exception to that. Who else in business gets this kind of assurance? It ties the hands of local government in a time of limited resources. Please do not support a bill that will make the job of a local government that much harder and more expensive. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Moskva? Representative Peterson.
I'd like to follow up on the question I had the previous testifier. Do you have contracts in Red Wing, or are all of these haulers just on their own?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Moskva.
Mr. Representative, we do not have contracts with any of the haulers in town. They've always brought the garbage to our facility. We believe in the fair market system where whoever could do the job did the job. Currently, with the sale of the local sanitation provider, we're not sure that that's going to continue.
Representative Peterson. Okay, thanks. Further question? Representative Horns.
Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I'm not. I followed this incineration stuff a few years back, but I'm not that familiar with your facility. What do you have state of the art equipment? I mean, are you emitting mercury still? And I know at one time that was a big concern, and I know there's toxic materials in the ash, et cetera. I mean, I have concerns that we're still looking at this 20-year-old hierarchy, which I think was drafted at a time when, you know, landfill technology wasn't quite what it is now, and incineration technology was probably a little overrated. So, you know, I happen to think that they're probably more equal on the hierarchy. There's no one size fits all. But I wanted to learn a little bit more about your facility and what exactly it's emitting into the environment.
Mr. Moskva.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative. As of March 5th of this year, there's no air emissions that you have to meet as a facility. There's no facility in the state that is allowed not to meet those. So we are online to do that. We have received grants from the OEA to get us online to that state.
Okay, but you see, Representative Hornstein.
You're currently not at that place, but you're trying to work towards it.
Mr.
Chair, Representative, no, we are in compliance with the air emissions law.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Mr. Haney, before we proceed any further, I'm looking at the time here. I don't want to cut anybody short. We can hold this over, but I'd like to see us finish it because Representative Thiessen's already been through a lot with our committee, being patient with us. I have three others to testify, and if at all possible, we'd like to finish on this bill. Mr. Haney.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Haney, representing the Minnesota Resource Recovery Association. I'll try to be very brief. We're opposed to the bill. We feel that it flies in the face of the Minnesota Waste Management Act passed around 1980. Makes it much more difficult for the counties to manage the waste. Counties are now charged with managing the waste under the Waste Management Act, and they frequently act or work through the city governments as well, and this makes it much more expensive to do, but it also acts as a disincentive for a city to look at the process should they want to get into organizing their collection more, whether it be for a facility like you just heard about, or because there's safety concerns, other environmental concerns, or rate concerns that the citizens might have with the existing hauler. Again, we're opposed to the bill. We feel it ties government's hands in a lot of different ways, and we urge you to vote against the bill.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Haney? Representative Wardlaw.
I've heard twice now. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Twice now I've heard people talk about fair market value and rate concerns, and if the folks don't like the rates, that's what free market's all about. I don't understand how what you're doing now is any better than this bill would do, because if someone thinks the hauler's too high a rate, they can just change haulers anyway. But I don't understand how this bill hurts you that way.
Mr. Haney. Mr. Chair, Representative, the Minnesota Resource Recovery Association represents the waste-to-energy facilities, not the haulers. But from the standpoint that we've looked at it, you know, what is a free market system? And sometimes it's difficult for a citizen to change haulers because of arrangements the haulers might have amongst themselves. Or, you know, I mean, it's hard to say. From our standpoint, we have, working with the counties, the overall responsibility to manage the waste within the county, and an integrated resource management plan that the counties have adopted can include a lot of different things. One of them is extensive recycling, burning the garbage that's not recyclable to generate electricity with it, and landfilling whatever is left over at a minimum. I'm not sure if that addresses your question, but...
Representative Wardlaw.
I guess it does. I don't know. I'm getting invitations to change haulers all the time. You know, if I want to change my garbage hauler, it's very easy for me to do in where I live. I like that freedom to switch to anybody I want. I guess that's what I'm concerned about. I hate to see a small business owner lose their business because local government is shutting some out. That's what bothers me.
Mr. Chair, one thing, you know, it seems that some of the issues that have been raised today by some of the haulers they're relatively smaller haulers compared to the big players in the industry. And some of that concern is just addressed by due diligence when you go through your plan on whether to purchase somebody else's business or not. But it's really, from what I've learned over the years, the smaller haulers, you know, they're really... Their big fear seems to be more of the big haulers, and I think that's what this bill is really trying to address, is the big hauler issues, the issues that have been raised by the other people, I think are more easily addressed.
Thank you. Next we have Craig Johnson with the League of Cities, and then David Benke, if I'm stating that correctly. Welcome to the committee. You could be extremely brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have committed to a one-minute limit here. So, my name is Craig Johnson. I'm representing the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Representative Thiessen for the work he's done with his amendments on this bill to address concerns that the League has raised in past committees and last session as this bill was argued. And I also would point out that many of the arguments I would make were already made by the representative from the City of Red Wing, so if you would, you know, please second my comments onto his. He covered city issues on this fairly well. A couple of particular points. One is that it is a regular and necessary part of any government decision-making, local or state, to decide how best to provide or contract for publicly needed services. Solid waste is not any different than any other public service that is provided, except that it has people who drive on the streets with very large trucks and do individual client-based marketing. The businesses that participate in serving any customer, public or private, regularly are at risk of losing that customer base. It happens all the time. And so I don't see that there is any special circumstance here other than what happens with any other service that is provided. If the situation changes in a local government area, a sudden growth in the community, a change in the type and use of roads, there's going to be a need to have that sort of flexibility to make those decisions. Last point I would make is that, referring to Representative Wardlow's comment earlier, a community that doesn't have contracts and switches to doing a contract-based form of solid waste collection and limits how many of those contracts they're going to issue would be liable for a takings under this. By going to contracts, they can often leverage an overall lower rate for the whole community than you would have gotten as an individual person if you just called and tried to get service.
Mr. Benke?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is David Benke with the Office of Environmental Assistance. The office opposes this bill consistent with the testimony earlier. The only thing I'd like to add is that the process itself already exists on statute for organized collection. It's a lengthy public participatory process which requires criteria to be met, including the minimization of displacement of haulers or collectors, ensuring that participation by all interested parties occurs, and that the decision-making process is done in a way that everyone's notified and is participating. And last, it maximizes the efficiency in the solid waste collection. We believe this bill changes those requirements unduly, and we'd like to preserve this tool for the local units of government to implement our integrated waste management system.
Representative Cornish, I apologize if I passed over you. I had understood.
I
thought your questions were for the author.
I was just going to ask if you had, were going to hold it over, because I had about three questions.
Well, if the committee would like to hold this over, we can. If we'd like to finish the work, I guess I understand now from staff that we can push the time a little bit.
I can roll them all into one.
Representative Cornish, try it. We have one amendment, too.
For me?
Yeah.
Okay.
For the haulers, I kind of apologize because I'd given the impression I was going to vote for this bill, and then when I got my computer hooked up, I had a lengthy letter here from my solid waste person back there, and they make, you know, a number of good points. I won't read it to you, but they think the municipality is ultimately liable for the proper disposal, and they're wondering why we're getting in the way of, you know, city business and local control, and they're worrying about this carrying over to other forms of solid waste disposal in the future and setting a precedent. And so it kind of troubles me that we're getting into this affair between the cities, and if they want to annex something and they want to keep their service, the city-owned service, not only are they going to have to hire more employees, but they're also going to have to pay off private haulers, and it's going to increase the workload or the amount that the other citizens pay. And so I just got a number of problems when you're talking about a guaranteed payback here, and just the way it is right now, letting it work itself out seems more sense to me than to intervene and tell a city what it has to do after we keep saying local control, and then we go in and set the rules. So that's just, how do you view that, this county person getting a hold of me and saying those things?
Thank you. A couple of things. First, the counties are not involved. They're not covered by this bill.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is with regard to local control, I don't see this as getting involved in local control at all, because they can continue, the cities can make any decisions that they otherwise would have made. They just have to, you know, to compensate someone. So I think the analogy too, that someone made to having your house, and that the city could come in, for instance, for annexation and then tell you to, that you don't meet code or whatever under their new code and take your house but not have to compensate you, that wouldn't be fair. And I think this is a similar situation. As to the issue of liability, that's an issue that's come up, and in fact, the city or the county, but although it doesn't apply to counties, the city is only liable for the waste that, for the pollution from the waste that they generate. They're not liable in any way for the pollution that's generated within their jurisdiction unless they're the generator of the waste. So the city's own waste, if it goes to a landfill, is a problem. There could be an issue, but they can deal with that by contracting with whomever they want to and saying, we want controls over how this happens. As everybody else's waste, there's not kind of some ongoing liability that they would have. The hierarchy that's put in place doesn't have any kind of remedies for not complying with. So they're supposed to put a plan together and try to control the waste, but there's no pollution liability attached to that. So I don't think that that's really a that legitimate a concern under the way current law is. Again, what this comes down to is, you know, what's fair? If someone's built up a business and then the city makes it, changes the rules on them, should they be able to just kind of put someone out of business, or should there be some compensation there?
Yeah, the only follow-up I'd have
would
be that the city feels they're changing the rules on them. I mean, they've got a good system going, they just want to keep their own service, but all of a sudden now they're having to make a deal and paying these people off, and and have an effect on their ability to do their business.
I mean, the one thing that they could do there, sorry, Mr. Chair, you know, is they could just allow, for the new part, they could just allow those people that were already there to continue in operation. And a similar thing with organized collection, what the city of Minneapolis did many years ago, is they had all these trucks running all over. And what they did is they just divided up the city on a proportionate basis, so no one lost any market share, but they were able to control how many trucks were running down a particular street in that way. You know, there are the tool that the cities are worried about having taken away is the ability to say either deal with us or you're out of business without compensation. I don't think that's an appropriate use of government power.
Representative Thiessen, while all these points are before us, I'm getting a sense, and I'm not hearing this, but I'm getting a sense from all the testimony, which has been good for and against, that this bill is coming from, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I'm really asking this, is this bill really coming from a difference with regard between the cities and the haulers with regard to where the waste is hauled? And if the waste isn't hauled to the right location, then the city comes in and they try to get new haulers? I'm looking at this amendment that would clarify that this does not would not apply, would only apply to a waste energy. Excuse me, I got to put this in front of the bill.
Right.
The amendment that we have to consider, represent.
Would you like me to offer that amendment so we can?
Actually, we need to hold this over. I think we're getting engaged here, but while we had all this, I really wanted to understand, and I see everybody shaking their head no. Representative Thiessen, final comment, and we'll have to hold
it. Do you want
to
address the amendment, or do you want to wait till...
We'll wait to address the amendment. Okay. I just noted by this amendment and comments combined that by seeing this point being raised as to a local unit of government that owns a waste energy facility.
I'll tell you, Mr. Chair, this amendment is aimed at Red Wing and resolving that issue.
Okay. As members, I appreciate members' perseverance. And
thank you. So what, 4:30?
4:30, room 300. We'll hold this poll over till then. Recess, 300 South. We'll hold this poll over till then. The committee is now in recess.
Thank you.
Thank you, members.